Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Agata Nwika. Agata is an investor at Lounds Capital and founder of Female Foundry, a community bringing together female founders and investors to accelerate the amount of capital being deployed to female entrepreneurs and to help diversify the ecosystem. If you want to learn more about Agata's background, do check out our primer episode, which we released a couple of days ago. But right now, let's get straight into it with Agata. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Amazing. So look, let's get straight into the detail. We were talking earlier about the current macroeconomic environment and climate. What, from your perspective, are the current challenges and potential opportunities that they bring? And also, what is the current macroeconomic climate from your perspective?
Sure. So obviously, we are living and breathing probably one of the slowest episodes of venture investing. And it comes to, you know, it's a kind of structural change that has been, in my opinion, driven by increased interest rates. Mm-hmm. Now, increased interest rates basically have given optionality for LPs to deploy their capital in other ways. And in the past couple of years, we've seen as well almost over-deployment of capital driven by, let's say, FOMO being created over the previous 2 years in that category. Now, that in itself creates a little bit of a slowdown when it comes to VCs, how VCs see their deployment strategy. So we've seen that the slowdown when it comes to deployment, but also funds raising new capital. And I don't think that this is going to fundamentally change. Now, this has got impact, obviously, as it trickles down to startups. So over the past, let's say, 5 months, 6 months, I've definitely observed, and this is happening, and I'm sure many people are aware of that, and founders and investors listening are definitely, again, living through that, is we've seen either companies looking for extension rounds, mm-hmm. so they're struggling to maybe they've slowed down their kind of growth, and they need that extra boost of capital to get them to the metrics for the next fundraising round. Or another category that I see as well is that almost kind of proactively, some founders that are in a better position are looking for that extension regardless to where they are in their fundraising journey.
Yeah.
So yes, it is a challenging ecosystem. And from my side, I've definitely seen a kind of an increase in terms of deal flow. But in my opinion, I'm actually quite positive about. I am of a view that any crisis actually breeds innovation, and it's positive actually to the ecosystem. So I'm very excited about what's going to be coming out of that. I think that eventually we're going to see stronger and more determined, and maybe more creative and innovative founders coming out of this phase.
Yeah, and what's really interesting, and we had a sort of similar conversation with Andrew Pozasti a couple of weeks ago from Angular, is that at the pre-seed seed levels, you know, there are founders out there currently with, you know, up to 2-3 years runway, but that makes no sense actually at those early stages where you really need to be moving very fast, deploying that capital. It strikes me that this balance needs to be struck with raising the right amount of capital to get you from milestone to milestone without sort of having that lingering, almost sort of over-capitalization of the balance sheet, which slows down growth. Whereas at the later stages, you probably do need that 2-3 years runway because, you know, at that point you're already, you know, at product market fit, you're already at go-to-market fit, and you need to now start, you know, proving that you can replicate the model again and again and keep growing. And I think where that capital balance lands is going to be really interesting. Certainly, you know, the other thing that I would definitely agree with from what you said is, obviously, in a higher interest rate environment, you have, to your point, LPs are able to find better returns or potentially you know, higher returns from more traditional products, obviously from the debt markets and from treasury bills and so on, and that trickles down into the entire ecosystem, but it takes time to trickle down as well, right?
Yeah.
So you know, for our listeners, I guess the impact that has is LPs are slower to deploy, VCs are therefore slower to raise and to deploy, therefore founders are going to have a harder time raising their capital. And of course, also, as we know, over the last several years, just with inflated rounds, the reason we're also seeing a lot of bridges is because founders have realized that they raised at too high a level previously, haven't met the milestones to be able to really prove out, you know, a larger raise at a larger valuation. And that then is causing them to try and find those sort of bridge capital. I think that's super interesting. And I think, I think, you know, especially for emerging fund managers, where you're both trying to raise capital from LPs as a new fund manager, you're deploying as a new fund manager, so you're also having to hunt and scout deals, you know, on a regular basis. And obviously, as you said, there's lots of deal flow. The question is, how much of that deal flow is investable today? It's a really interesting place to be in. So yeah, no, that makes a huge amount of sense. To change tack for a second, you started off life as an architect. How did you make the decision to jump from architecture into founding your own businesses and not only your own businesses, but fintech ventures? I mean, that seems like a bit of a leap.
Definitely. So I will tell you, I know it sounds like a leap, but I think that the way I actually studied architecture and actually practiced architecture, it's maybe not typical to some people how architecture is viewed. So how I learned architecture was in a very abstract way. Actually, the ceilings, walls is just an application layer of the design process that happens in your head. Now, that design process is very abstract. We are talking about systems, thinking in terms of systems, triggers, sequences.
And events,
Exactly, which is pretty much as technology works. So I didn't realize when I was an architect that I was pretty much, of course, we did actually programming actually during our studies, which definitely helped to make that transition later on. But just coming back to your point about the how I made that jump, because it wasn't obvious. So I worked as an architect in Hong Kong in a very exciting actually role, traveling around Asia, designing high-end resorts and experiencing that Chinese property boom in 2013. But basically because I had that opportunity early on, that learning curve started to flatten quite quickly. And at the same time, I identified this opportunity on the market, basically. On one hand, I saw the community of expats that wanted to pay extra for convenience. And on the other hand, I was dealing with these factories that were happy to get rid of their inventory. And I thought, okay, there's something happening
here. A bit of an arbitrage you can make.
Yes, exactly. So I've built a business basically around that opportunity, a marketplace that basically would deliver on the subscription basis travel goods to the expat community. And for some reason, somehow, because we were early in the kind of e-commerce space, it was very cheap business to run, incredibly concentrated customer group as well. Somehow I hit the nail on the head, which is sometimes, you know, timing is everything, yes?
100%, I know
actually. So, I just at some point I quit the job and I just kept doing what was working out. And I didn't know that I was building this data and analytics business, actually, eventually. That was my transition. It was pretty much very much opportunistic. I was super young and I was happy, still happy to take any money risks. That hasn't changed. It's just, probably when you're somewhere on the other side of the world, I think that you're willing to take even bigger leaps. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I think that cultural diversity kind of also highlights where there are opportunities. I mean, having lived overseas many, many years myself, like you can see where, you know, where people see things in a slightly different, from a different perspective, because obviously you aren't sort of within the culture necessarily. So you don't, you know, you the status quo for them is not the status quo that you see, and you can see those opportunities.
Exactly.
What's really interesting to me, actually, one of my front-end developers in one of my businesses, she's unfortunately no longer in the business, but she also was an architect from Taiwan. I hadn't really thought about the kind of technical the technical background that that training gives you, because it's a highly mathematical, highly theoretical sort of field to operate in. And actually, as you say, yes, it's all about translating that sort of design thinking and systems thinking into, you know, into technology, which obviously from an engineering perspective, and that's why we use the term engineer, is basically doing the same thing.
Yeah. And I would say one thing that is also exciting, even more exciting than being in architecture, you know, the implementation execution cycles are so incredibly long.
Yeah.
Okay, in Hong Kong, it was super fast, I must say.
Sure.
The fastest I think I can imagine, because there's no health and safety. At least there was no health and safety at that time.
And there's a lot of people out there waiting to work in construction.
Working 24 hours a day, but still you can't really see the results that fast. Whereas in technology, it happens super fast as you want it, really.
Yeah.
And it's only driven by your ambition and how you see the end of how big do you want that thing to be, which is incredibly rewarding. So I've actually enjoyed that transition very much.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting as a founder and you know, speaking to other founders as well, that iteration loop and that feedback loop becomes super addictive, because you're constantly learning. And it sounds like actually a lot of what drove this was this desire to learn. In fact, you talked about it in our primer episode, you know, you're keen to learn about some of these new sort of areas that you're focused on. But it sounds like, you know, you mentioned you came to the top of the learning curve and it started flattening, and then that's why you dived into this. I think that's often one of the trigger points for a lot of founders, right? They either see where something isn't working, or they've stopped learning and want to explore something new. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Switching a little bit, let's talk about Female Foundry, right?
Yeah.
So Female Foundry has 5,000 subscribers currently to the newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And a pretty stellar open rate, like over, you know, close to 50%, if not more. Why is there such a clear need and demand and desire for platforms and communities like this? I mean, what is it that's driving that, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's imbalance. Again, and we talked about this opportunity, any opportunity that emerges, there's always some imbalance that is not sustainable in the ecosystem. So in my opinion, you know, even dialing back 3-4 years ago, when venture capital firms were still operating behind closed doors, and COVID, in my opinion, changed that.
Yep.
There was not much accountability when it comes to how venture capital firms operated, but also where that capital was going. And that's changed. Now there's much more accountability, transparency being, let's say, demanded from the ecosystem. And suddenly when you open that, let's say, hood, you realize that the statistics are just appalling, and they actually don't make sense. Like, they literally don't make sense. For me as an investor, they don't make sense, because you can't have really 30% of entrepreneurs being women,
but
and then
2%
cutting capital. So, because one thing that I want to say, I'm not a feminist, even though Female Foundry is the name. I'm not a feminist.
That's gonna get a lot of controversy. I think we're gonna have to clip that.
I know.
We're gonna have to put that right out there in the trailer.
And I'm very proud of that, to be honest. What drives me really, and what's been driving me to bring Female Foundry forward, has been equity of opportunities, because that's what I've seen as a founder myself. That's what I've seen as an angel investor, even, and then as a kind of operating now from within venture capital industry. That's what I see all the time. So, what drives me still are returns, and I think that we are still not maximizing the returns based on the lack of diversity.
And you think so the appetite for a platform like Female Foundry comes from that imbalance.
Yeah.
But is there some sort of an information gap as well? Because there are a number of these platforms out there for female founders. You know, we've had people like Emmy Faust on previously, who's built a similar sort of platform. I think we have someone coming on in the future from Hive. And there's a number of these platforms out there, and they seem to be very focused on either female founders or on diverse ethnicities, right? So obviously underrepresented and marginalized potential groups. And I obviously intrinsically, I believe in what you're doing and why there is a need. But is there some sort of information asymmetry, which means that female founders or people from other backgrounds or underrepresented backgrounds just have less access, not necessarily just the capital, but to the knowledge or the people? Or is there even, you know, dare I say it, some sort of imposter syndrome that kind of floats throughout all of us that, that, you know, it often feels to me, and I see posts like this all the time, you know, you have a white, you know, male 20 to 30 year old founder who's like, oh, I just raised $1.5 million in capital. And you look behind the hood and there's not much happening in the business. Whereas, you know, female founders, maybe other founders from more diverse backgrounds have a hesitation to kind of put themselves out there and say, you know, this is investable today.
Yep.
They're always waiting or trying to build it to the point where they think it'll be investable and therefore they miss a boat. Is that...
Definitely. I would definitely agree with that. I think there's a combination of few things happening. Definitely as a female founder, again, ex-female founder, there's a... I think that women overall have got this tendency of over-delivering. And unless they over-deliver, they think that they are not good enough. So definitely, you know, right now I have, I work with both female and male founders and I see tremendous difference, even how they pitch their businesses. And that's what I want to transcend through Female Foundry, that kind of level of confidence. And one thing that I want to mention, because I think that what's unique about Female Foundry compared to the some of the platforms that you mentioned is that from the beginning, my objective has been to bring the ecosystem together, meaning... Actually, you know, when you think about even subscribers of Female Foundry, 40% of community are VC investors. 30% of our subscribers are men, actually. So it's about bringing that balance, again, VCs, founders, male versus or not even versus, and women. and I think that's with that kind of, with that, only with that kind of approach, this inclusive approach, we'll be able to make a difference. We are going to bring that confidence when it comes to, you know, imposter syndrome or female founders kind of lacking that confidence, or in terms of that education as well. So, for example, in my newsletter, weekly newsletter, I cover the entire ecosystem. So I focus on founders, but also emerging managers, also investors. And it's interesting, I've been getting lots of feedback from actually female founders saying, Agata, you cover aspects I never realized actually they were important for me. So something that we talked about earlier, you know, dry powder, where the dry powder comes, okay, LP. So I need to understand actually what's happening in the macroeconomic level to understand why I'm not getting this kind of traction. So there's a lot of kind of education that happens, let's say spontaneously, by giving that access, that knowledge to founders in the first place.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Proud to be one of the 30% male subscribers to the newsletter. I read it religiously. I think there's an amazing amount of value for anyone. It doesn't necessarily need to be that you are a female founder. And interestingly, what I would take from what you just said, and I think you know that's exactly the right way of thinking about it. In order to affect change throughout the ecosystem, you need to have everyone in the ecosystem involved, right? And the reality today is that a lot of capital, a lot of founders, a lot of investors are male, right? They are sitting on those pools of capital. And unless they can be exposed, I guess, to you know, this wider range of diversity within the ecosystem, it's harder for them to make, it is easier for them not to make a decision. And one of the things I definitely agree with, right? I see... You know, I see a lot of female founder focused funds or you know, angels or whatever it might be. And, you know, and you have platforms like Alma Angels, which obviously is very focused on female founders as well. But the reality is that I think, you know, throughout the ecosystem, especially if you're looking for venture funding, one has to be really conscious of the fact that not all businesses receive venture funding.
Yeah,
and 100%. Therefore, you need to understand what it is that is required if you want to move down that track. And also whether that pathway is even something that you want to take on. I personally, you know, tried to raise VC funding for my own business, was not able to, but I was trying to raise in the worst possible time. But equally also accept that, you know, the business didn't have the traction that it probably needed, and we actually pivoted pretty hard. But the reality is, even with the networking connections I have, it is not a given that you're going to raise venture funding, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, understanding what those dynamics are, I think, is super, super interesting. And so where do you see Female Foundry going? What is the end objective that you're looking to do? Is it just continue to kind of put out this resource and education for founders, or is there is there a goal that you're aiming towards?
Sure. So through Female Foundry, I must say, over the past few months, I've been getting incredible deal flow to start with. So that's, at the beginning, I was keeping it open-ended. But since I've actually, since, I don't know, a few months, since I've opened up this pitch box kind of initiative, I've been speaking with about 12 to 15 founders a week. And I would say maybe 20%. I'm sorry for those that are not going to be included. Have been absolutely actually amazing. So that's been leading me towards obviously thinking about setting up my own fund.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in a bit.
So that's, I'm not saying this is the end goal, because I would say I still want to play the role. Female founders should still play an ongoing role, a little bit like Techstars, for example, does, with providing educational and kind of support across the ecosystem, but really only few startups are part of the accelerator program. So I think that there is a space for Female Foundry, and definitely there's a huge space, wide and open still, for many entrants in this space. And I think that I would love to prove that there are incredible women founders, not better than men. There's no case like that. There's no case better or worse. It's like there are incredible, driven, you know, ambitious women that should be getting funded.
And the interesting thing actually is that I don't have the numbers to hand, but I think venture outcomes see, in general, better outcomes from female-founded businesses than they do from male-founded businesses as a percentage of the total invested. So it's crazy that more investment doesn't flow. And like, you know, we all know, you know, underrepresented groups or marginalized groups in general tend to have just that little bit more hunger and a little bit more sort of tenacity and resilience to go out there and really do stuff. So let's talk about female founders. For women building their ventures today, what do you see as the biggest challenges? And I guess more importantly, what are the solutions to those challenges?
Yeah, I always focus on solutions, actually. I don't like to state the obvious. And I think that overall, let's be honest, I've done it twice, or actually I've done it four times. I don't talk about two smaller ventures that I just set up to fund my MBA, because they had a close end.
I mean, if you funded your MBA with a venture, that's pretty impressive in and of itself. And I know how much INSEAD exactly can set you back. Yeah, for sure.
Yes. Ooh. Still at the, you know, the shadow of that experience.
Yeah, some debt for a while.
Setting up venture is a super hard job, let's say, and it only takes a certain kind of people, you know, certain kind of character to set it up. So there's a kind of level of challenge that I think that some people would think that it's would be called as crazy, but for me, it's just a job as normal as a founder. So some of the challenges, and I don't want to talk too much about them, obviously, is current economic climate doesn't make it easy for you if you have an idea, if you have a concept. There are increased expectations from investors when it comes to your metrics. How do you get metrics if you don't get funding? How do you raise funding if your family and friends, you know, pay increased electricity bills? So then it favors those, you know, the privileged group.
Comfortable. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, but more specifically, what founders, in my opinion, can, what steps they can take? First of all, I think it's about being maximizing impact and really becoming frugal and really focusing on what is absolutely necessary. And I think that kind of mindset always helps at the beginning, you know, leveraging open data, kind of low code tools to build that MVP, not really waiting, first of all, not waiting for too much for approval. You know, me with that kind of fail fast and mindset that I adopted from architecture, actually, it's I would say, becomes crucial in the current.
Learn quickly
and really fail fast. And really not waiting for perfecting their product until they speak, you know, they speak with potential customers and users. So that becomes even more crucial. So that would be one. Secondly, really thinking about really understanding the dynamic of the current market and really working with the current dynamic, meaning, yes, it's going to take me longer to raise capital.
So therefore, what do I need to do?
Yeah. What is my growth profile is going to look like? I always encourage founders actually to look back, you know, at least from Series A, if you're at the pre-seed stage, at least look at what do you want. Of course, that image is not going to be perfect and it's going to change, but what try to visualize what your business is going to look like at Series A and why you're going to raise that capital at the Series seeds around at the Series A stage, because that's how venture capitalists work. You know, your
how
metrics.
How do I get to the next round?
Yeah. Exactly. Your ability of raising capital is their metrics, basically,
yeah.
For their LP. So really understanding how can I translate my story clearer and better for them to see that a potential of me raising multiple rounds of financing to start with. Not many founders, which is quite interesting, really have got that clarity. They focus on here and now, and they don't really focus on what my business can look like and should look like, and what are the forces, what are the, let's say I call them winds, I can take as a, like a sailing boat on the way to accelerate that progress. So, and that can be done very quickly, and, you know, really having this adaptive mindset, really being prepared for unknown and for many things to be changing along the journey. So I'm an optimist, and I love failing, actually, because for me failing is actually getting closer to the answer, and that's what, you know, I'm a kind of execution and kind of driven. So for me, it's something that I know personally came very naturally. But as I've been going through mentorship and advisory work, I realized that that's something that many founders need to learn. Yeah. And it's a muscle. It's a muscle. You need to develop that muscle.
Well, I think there's fear, right? Like people have a strong fear of failure. I coined a phrase on Twitter, didn't really go anywhere, but I call entrepreneurs success fails or success failures, right? Or an entrepreneur can be it only really works when they are success fail. And what I mean by that is they go through a series of failures to get to success.
Yeah.
And you can't actually be an entrepreneur if you haven't been through that. I mean, like the definition of an entrepreneur is someone that risks their own capital, time or money or whatever it might be to try and build, you know, a business that didn't exist. And if you don't have that fail fast, fail often mindset, and I'd almost pivot that to learn fast, learn often mindset. You know, you can struggle to move forward. And I think, you know, the other thing that you said there that was super interesting, we had Annalisa Dragish on from Sapphire Ventures recently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that she saw happening in the ecosystem is, at the moment is, rather than compression or rounds being done at Series B and beyond in a different way to what was happening over the past few years, there's been an acceleration of earlier stage VC, so seed Series A, looking to exit their positions earlier, because obviously they need to show TVPI, they need to show DPI, they need to show the metrics again, as you said, to their LP so they can go out and raise their next fund. Mm-hmm. And that then puts pressure on founders to try and get to the metrics to get out, raise those larger rounds. And to your point, that is how VCs think.
Yeah.
And therefore, as a founder, you need to be thinking, okay, what are the metrics I need to prove out to get to Series B at this valuation, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, you know, a VC mentality is going to be, if this isn't going to return my fund or isn't going to show the 8x return or 10x or 100x return, realistically, that a lot of funds want to achieve. Although let's also be very clear, most funds return 1.8 if they're lucky, right? And actually, I think I saw some metrics that showed 50% of funds since 2010 haven't returned more than the S&P, right?
Oh, wow.
So they're basically pretty low.
That's the reality.
Not even 1x the S&P. So So as a founder, you've got to learn how to think in that way, right?
100%.
Because otherwise you're going to struggle.
And then let's be honest, you know, we are on the same journey. You know, there's such a clear alignment of incentives. So it's, VCs really should be allowing you and helping you to accelerate your growth and your success. And hopefully there are many, many more today, I want to believe, VCs that want to be hands-on involved as part of this journey, as opposed to only providing capital.
Yeah, no, for sure. And again, you know, we had a really great conversation with Kelvin Al from Cell Capital recently. And, you know, they're a thematic investor, so they have certain themes that they focus on. But the core belief on his side, and I agree, is this whole thing about, can we be helpful, right? Yeah. Where is the value add from venture? The value add, you know, over the last 5-6 years, whilst capital was abundant, was like, yeah, just give me more money and I'll figure it out. Today, the value add actually is, can you introduce me to XYZ in this business so that I can make that sell? Or can you can you introduce me to XYZ who is potentially going to be a follow-on investor? So it is really working with the ecosystem hand in hand to figure out how you can drive the business forward.
One thing that I want to just make a point on this, because I think that what I'm observing with founders is that their tendency today, obviously because, let's say, capital is scarce, is to go with anyone who provides that capital. Sure. And it's literally shooting yourself in the foot.
And there are lots of bad actors out there, for sure.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. But even, let's focus on good actors. Even for those, if you're, what I'm trying to say, there are founders that now prioritize capital, which is obviously instinctively, you would say, natural in given the state of the ecosystem. But I think that what will happen very quickly, once you get that capital that is only capital, meaning there's no value add from the funds that you will be raising from, is that, you know, we are going to be coming out of this state of affairs, let's say, in the next few months. I'm really strong believer of that.
Wow, that's very optimistic.
A few months, meaning at the end of this year.
Sure.
We are going to see, in my opinion. You know, it's all, I think that interest rates will need to come down at some point.
Interesting.
And that will, again, unwind everything that's been created. So, nevertheless, you will need to raise the next round of capital. And how will you be able to do that based on improved metrics? How will you be able to improve metrics if you don't have that support from existing investors? And therefore, in my opinion, if I were a founder today, I would still be looking for capital, sources of capital that can give me that extra network, access to networks or really operational even assistance. To make sure that that next round of financing is on my terms.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I have no direct experience. I doubt any VC would say this to me, but my assumption also is how you construct your cap table does have an impact, obviously, on your future round. Not just in terms of, obviously, the dilution that you as a founder have taken. Yeah. Obviously, a lot of female or underrepresented founders will take on too much dilution because they are, desperate, quote unquote, to get the capital. But also, if the wrong investor is on your cap table, that puts off investors further down the track as well.
100%. So if anything, I would, to be honest, maybe it will sound controversial, but I would be fine with more dilution as long as I know I have a guarantee, let's say, to a certain degree, guaranteed help along the way to improve these metrics, because I know that I would catch up on that valuation in the next round, as opposed to taking capital, maybe a little bit of less dilution, but then not being able to meet those metrics along the way.
And not only that, I guess, you know, I've said before, actually, you know, over dilution is not a reason not to take capital in a down market. Like, if you've got the right investor on board, then you should definitely consider that. And I guess for a lot of founders, what they don't realize is that there are ways of fixing your cap table down the track, right? Yeah. Like a good Series A, Series B investor will put in, you know, reverse vesting options, you know, to make you whole as a founder if they really believe in what you're doing.
So, and the last point is that today, most of the startups, the nice situation is that most of the startups are in the same boat.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be really judged against others. So that's the opportunity. Yeah. So those founders that are able to, therefore, coming back to the current market, where the opportunities are, I think that it's for those founders who think strategically.
It's almost leveled the playing field, I guess,
exactly.
Is the point, right?
Yes.
So you have better opportunity. You're not fighting against kind of, the FOMO crowd that are, have just been investing in everything left, right, and center. Who knows how those outcomes are going to be in the next 5, 6, 7 years. Mm. So just moving on, like you mentioned earlier about raising your own fund, right? Mm-hmm. So, nothing ventured. I launched this podcast because I have a strong belief that, people need to back themselves. They need to put their, put their first foot forward and take that first step, and take that leap of faith and really back themselves when they're moving, into either building their own business or raising a fund. But, you're dabbling with that at the moment. What are the considerations? What are the challenges? What are the first steps even? Like, how are you thinking about that?
Yeah. So it's interesting because again, we are probably, I read somewhere in the worst in 20 years climate for raising your own funds. But how I've been thinking about it, obviously what matters probably the most is your track record. Mm. And again, I wasn't really considering raising my own fund 3-4 years ago. And when I was doing investing post that exit, I wish I was there today. I would have plenty of opportunities of proving myself. So my now emphasis is on building that track record, whether it is being part of advisory board even or deploying small Andrew tickets. So that's probably my first priority. Secondly, really making sure that the community that I'm building with Female Foundry is of high quality founders. So again, putting myself out there, but also taking myself accountable in terms of quality of content and kind of that can resonate with high quality as well founders. I believe in that. So I'm doing that proactively in any case. But and also one other aspect that I know that I'm missing is building the team around you.
Sure.
Which in my opinion, I'm an immigrant. I have so many diversity, not all of them, but many are diversity aspects. I would love to build a diverse team because around Female Foundry, including men, including people from different backgrounds, because I really believe that the best outcomes are the combination of multiple diverse backgrounds, at the table.
100%, which is in direct opposition to the the batshit article that came out from the Wall Street Journal. That suggested that, had SVB not had a diverse team, if there were 12 men around the table, maybe they wouldn't have failed.
Yes.
Or 12 white men around the table, maybe they wouldn't
I'm
have failed.
I'm not sure how they managed to put it through the editor.
Absolutely crazy. Yeah. But I mean, it is proven, and again, I don't have the numbers to hand, that more diverse teams lead to better outcomes. And, I think I had Jelaine Chan on some times ago. She's an incredible sort of COO operator, ex-Microsoft. And, what she said, I remember she said, she gave me this anecdote of, a session that she was at, and the lady came on stage and said, if there'd been a woman on the team designing the iPhone, it wouldn't have been black because no woman can find a black phone in their handbag. Right? And I mean, like that's a very flippant kind of silly example, if I
but
can put
like
it that way.
Yeah.
But it makes sense, right? Like, I mean, I think that is really important.
Yeah.
Having that diversity on board.
Yeah.
Agata, it's been absolutely amazing having you here with me on the podcast today. I'm so, so appreciative of you having taken the time to come out here. For our listeners, where can they find you? Where can they find Female Foundry?
Yeah.
What are your handles online?
Sure.
Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? where can they best find you?
So first of all, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
What you're doing at Nothing Ventured, it's absolutely amazing. I really believe that eventually you're going to be raising your own fund. I think that,
we shall see. I need to build a track record for sure.
You're just too good and too involved. Something needs to come out of it. It's just a matter of time.
Fingers crossed.
So in terms of where people can find me, I'm the most responsive on LinkedIn. So Agata Leliwanowicka. There, I'm not that engaged on Twitter. I'm not a multi-channel person. And Female Foundry, yes, it's femalefoundry.co. Mm-hmm. Please check us out. Whoever you are, wherever you are in your journey, would love to be creating a diverse community.
Well, we'll definitely be adding the links in the show notes. Agata, once again, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.